What's up, fam? It's your boy, Z-Dog MD, aka Dr. Zubin Demania. I am live and direct out of Z office. Check it out. Today, I want to talk a little bit about the podcast I did a few days back on the mind system that was based on this book, The Mind Illuminated. It's all backwards because the way I've set my iPhone right now. It actually generated a lot of great discussion, and I was really excited to see that people are interested in exploring sort of, you know, it's an interesting word, spirituality. It's really a study of the mind. It's introspection and trying to figure out how the mind works. And there's probably not a better word than spirituality in a secular context. So in a scientific empirical context, you can actually study the mind and use sort of ancient philosophy, but also modern neuroscience to better understand how we think, how we react, how we behave, and use that as a vehicle to improve ourselves in a way that actually reduces suffering, not just for us, but for everyone around us. And I'll tell you, in healthcare in particular, oh snap, we could use a lot more of that in our lives. So when I did that broadcast about the mind system, which I'll summarize briefly in the beginning of this talk, I thought no one was going to care about it because it can get a little esoteric. You can sound a little Deepak Chopra-ish, which is never a good idea. It feels like, oh, is he dabbling into weird Eastern religion? No, no religion, nothing to believe, simply a better way and a model, one model to understand how the mind works in a way that, again, we can improve it and reduce suffering. Now, the way I got into all this was starting to meditate. And the reason I titled this show McMindfulness is that in many ways now, meditation, mindfulness, all of this stuff has become so popular in the sort of popular canon as a way to reduce stress and improve performance and improve focus. And the medical people, a lot of medical systems and groups are trying to teach mindfulness to their staff and to their doctors and to their frontline clinicians and frontline hospital staff as a way to alleviate burnout. Now, before I even get into this, I want to say a couple things about that. You cannot, asking the victims of a broken system to become more mindful, to do yoga, to do deep breathing, to exercise, to take occasional vacations, right, is simply reframing the broken system in a way that they are compliant, able to function within it and carry out the tasks that are within it. What that does is an incredibly dangerous thing, which number one, it blames the victim, which is us, for being burned out. Well, if you were just more mindful, you know, your ish could get better and you could get through your day. No, we're not accepting that, Z-Pak. That's BS. The second problem with that is it is a way of saying, well, with equanimity and acceptance, we're going to accept the fact that our system's broke AF and we're just going to continue to function within it without burning out. Hugely bad idea, and it encourages the kind of potential inertia and acceptance of dysfunction that has led us to this problem. Now, true mindfulness, being aware of what's going on moment to moment, being in the present moment, and understanding how your mind works so you're more proactive and less reactive, and you come from a place of thoughtfulness, mindfulness, if you will, when you make decisions and act, means that number one, yes, we can function better in brokenness, but more importantly, we can see clearly the brokenness and work together through a better understanding of ourselves and others to actually transform the system as a whole. And that's ultimately the secret goal here, guys, is not to be compliant with this broken medical system, but to actually transform it. But to do that, we also have to undergo some personal understanding and transformation. So when I talk, let me pull up your comments here because I want to take your comments today and I want to look at some comments that were left on the video I did on the mind system. And again, the book is called The Mind Illuminated. It's linked to in the previous video and I'll throw a link to it in this as well. It's less about the book, although I think it's a great guide and a great way to understand the mind, understand how you meditate, the processes and the stages that you go through. And what's fascinating about it on my own sort of trip through this is that it's like the guy who writes it is in your head because he's done this. So he can tell you, okay, in this stage of your meditative practice, you are going to experience these inner sort of phenomenon of flashing lights. They may have a color. They may not have a color. They may seem like they're coming from above. Some people have those. Some people have this. Some people are hear this sort of tone. Some people have weird bodily sensations. And I'm like, oh, crap. That's exactly what I'm having, and I thought I was going insane. So the book is really good as a way to understand, oh, this must be a stereotypical way that the mind works. Now, to quickly summarize what I talked about before, the mind system model is based on sort of ancient Buddhist understanding of the mind, but it's really increasingly supported by modern neuroscientific understanding of how the mind works. It's as simple as this, and very complicated actually, but I'm gonna make it simple for the purposes of this discussion. The mind isn't one thing. There's not a little thinker behind your eyes making decisions. It is actually a system of these unconscious subminds. So there may be an auditory submind, a visual submind, a sensory body submind. So the sort of sense subminds. And then there's the sort of thinking submind that he calls the discriminatory submind. That could be doing math, planning ahead, inhibiting desires and actions based on a moral code that you have. It could be a sexual submind that's always out trying to get laid. It could be the emotional discriminatory submind that feels things, anger, disgust, love, those kind of things, happiness. So all these different subminds are there and they all function unconsciously. You're not aware of what they're doing most of the time. And they function together at the same time in parallel. So the question is, if this is true, and through meditation, through actual neuroscience, you can actually start to see, yeah, no, this actually is correct. Intuitively, it feels correct on many levels. So as these things are all functioning, they are all vying for attention. They're all vying for, they're trying to keep you alive. They're trying to get you to reproduce. They're aiming for the overall contentedness and happiness of your organism, you, your mind, body, this whole continuum that you are. But to do that, they're all working at the same time. So how do they communicate with each other? And how are you aware of what's going on? Well, these subminds are arranged in a boardroom, is the analogy, like at a corporate meeting room or a meeting room in your hospital, where they're all kind of sitting around a table. And in the center of that boardroom is a PowerPoint projector. And on that PowerPoint projector is projected one frame at a time, a moment of consciousness that we are actually aware of. And that frame is seen by all the subminds, which means they can all exchange data through this boardroom. The boardroom is conscious awareness. It's what we're actually aware of, which is a tiny fraction of what the mind is actually doing at any given time. So at this moment, my discriminatory submind is unconsciously processing stuff that happened earlier in the day. It's going through checklists of stuff that I'm gonna need to do. All this other stuff's happening in the background. The auditory submind hears my kid fooling around with her violin, hears some birds outside. And it's like, well, do I need to put this on the PowerPoint for the boardroom to see? All these kind of things are going on at once. So how do we function? Well, each of these things ends up throwing stuff into the boardroom and seeing what sticks. And whatever sticks is what we're paying attention to of that at that time. Some of it may be direct attention, like I'm paying attention to the phone in front of me that's recording the show. Or some of it may be peripheral awareness. So a moment of peripheral awareness where I'm just vaguely aware that I'm in a room, there's a computer here, there's an iPad with your comments, that kind of thing. In the setting of that, what determines what we pay attention to? Well, most of the time, it's an unconscious submind throwing stuff up with a strong enough intention. And the one that wins the intention battle, that thinks it's the most important, gets some screen time. And then all the other subminds get to look at that and go, oh, should we do anything about this? Do I need to pay a little more auditory attention to what's going on with that car crash that just draw my visual center, just draw my attention to? And now my thinking center is processing it going, I better go over there and see if I can help someone. All those kind of things happen instantaneously, like at some refresh rate per second. So you're getting just all this stuff on that screen. Just click, 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 all these moments of consciousness. String them together and you have experience, you have awareness, you have what it feels like to be us. So these subminds are working a lot of times not in concert to try to get your attention. So the question is, first of all, where's the I in all that? So this was the number one question that kind of came up. And a lot of people comment, like Dwight Christensen, isn't this the movie Inside Out by Pixar? Exactly. So in Inside Out, you see these subminds all trying to do their thing. And they're all trying to get her attention, right? The question is, who is this her? Who is the I that is getting attention. Well, one of the subminds is a submind called the narrating submind. Its job is to take all the input that comes into that boardroom from all these other little minds and bind it together. Go, you know what? Auditory said this, visual said this, thinking said this. Snapshot is you're in a room, there's a bird outside, and you're thinking that this bird is beautiful. And so all that is a binding moment that comes up on the screen. Whoop, oh, by the way, this is the context. What that does is it goes back to the thinking submind, the discriminatory submind, that then ties it into an I, a sensation of I. I am in a room seeing a bird and hearing this bird, and I think this bird is a red-breasted robin or whatever. Now, the I that's created in that phenomenon is entirely an illusion. It's something that's sort of developed by the discriminatory mind in response to this narrating mind, in response to the stimuli. But what's really going on? Raw information is being created by these subminds. And remember, I said created. None of this is actually real because we don't know what reality really is. It's the subminds generating this and serving it up to us in awareness. So our mind creates our reality, and then the creation here is some input, presumably from outside, is generating a bird, generating a memory of a bird, identifying it through the discriminatory submind, seeing it there, hearing the bird song, and then binding it all together in narration. Then the discriminatory submind says, I see a bird and I remember it's this. This I is the basis of most of the misunderstandings of what it is we actually are. There's no little I sitting in your mind. In Inside Out, there's no one person in that movie, one little submind, being her. It's this consensus of different things that are happening unconsciously to her. She's not aware of them. And then this boardroom where things just appear and you're actually aware, that's really what we as a mind system are. We're the awareness in which all this unconscious activity becomes clear. So the lack of this self, this I, the more you meditate, the ultimate goal of meditation, at least in the sort of Theravada tradition and many of the traditions, Tibetan traditions, etc., the ultimate goal of this is to develop enough concentration, enough inner awareness of how the mind system works, that that insight becomes clear that, wow, there is no self. Things are just arising moment to moment in the present moment, which means there's no me to feel bad about, to hate, to regret, and actually that's a liberating thing. Now, again, I'm not even doing this concept justice because you have to experience the sense of selflessness to actually really have it intuitively make sense. And many people will have these glimpses through their lives, right? And actually in meditation, there are certain experiences that you can have that if you were living in zero AD, you might interpret through the lens of a Christian experience or a Muslim experience or a Judaic experience and attribute it to God or angelic voices or whatever you have. And in my scientific sort of secular experience, when I have those meditative experiences, I attribute it to, oh, the subminds, and this is what the book talks about, these subminds actually slowly start to unify around a single goal, which is maybe focus on the breath or focus on compassion or whatever your meditation is. And it's that slow unification of the subminds that through repeated practice and work through meditation actually generates feelings of bliss, of peace, of compassion for all living things, of letting go of regret and self-hatred and all these other things, because you start to realize the self in itself is an illusion. And a lot of what we do is unconscious conditioning. And once we recognize it, we can actually transform the way we actually behave in the world. So let's read some comments. Mursad Sardarovich, yes, experience it. It's the only way to know it. Mursad, this is the trick. You can talk about meditation. You can talk about the mind system model. You can talk about it. You can look at fMRI. You can look at neuroscience and psychological studies that really back it up. But none of it will make sense to you until you actually go down the path of meditative introspection and actually experience it. I would have thought it was crazy. I would have thought it was BS. And the truth is, that's why a lot of people do. They reject it out of hand. Now, McMindfulness in our current culture says, oh, just close your eyes and think about the present moment and get a Headspace app and do that. Now, all that's great, but you are not even, I tell you, because I've been doing this for 5 years now, trying to meditate. And I have failed for the majority of that time. What I found out in retrospect is I was just sitting with my eyes closed thinking about meditating. And that is not, you're missing a whole piece of it. And I think a lot of people who go down the mindfulness path that's being popularized are missing the fundamental boat. Now, here's the thing. When I caught the boat, first of all, it's quite a bit of diligence. You have to do it every day. You have to set time to do it. You have to maybe cut something else out of your life to do it. So I stop checking email in the morning. I stop looking at Facebook. I go right into an hour of meditation using the guide in this book. So it starts out very distracted and dumb, and then you get into it. But as you start to experience it, I have absolutely no doubt. There are times when I have experiences in meditation, when I'm learning about it, and an insight clicks where I want to go live right then and tell you guys, don't even fool around. Go and do this now. Start working on this because it's absolutely a real phenomenon. And the only way to know it, which is why it's so hard for scientists, the only way to know it is to experience it yourself. And Mirsad said it best. You have to do it yourself because it's introspection. It's subjective experience. It's sitting in your conscious boardroom, watching your subminds do stuff. Now, here's the most amazing thing about that before I take some more questions. You can actually, understanding this mind system model and understanding that you have this consciousness boardroom where only one thing can be displayed at a time in a little mind moment, and that intention, in other words, conscious intention, executive function, making these complex decisions and carrying them out, what that really is, there's no one little guy in your brain going, I'm going to have an apple, right? Or I'm going to have a cheeseburger. It's a consensus of the subminds. And it happens a lot of times unconsciously. When you're actually aware of struggling to make a decision, what's happening is the subminds are in conflict. And one wants to do this, the other wants to do that. Another part of the discriminatory submind wants to be healthy. The other one's like just wants to have a good, like the hedonic feeling of eating really good cheeseburgers. And when they're in conflict, then it goes back and forth. Then you're aware of conflict and you start going back and forth in your mind. And then you ultimately decide. The decision is when one or more of the subminds have won out and they're like, nope, this is what we're doing, guys. Everybody else shut up. Let's go along for the ride. And a lot of times, if you're not paying attention to that, if you're doing that on autopilot, you're going to make a decision that later you're going to be like, why the hell did I do that? Whereas if you're mindful, you're aware of what's going on and you're weighing this stuff and you're seeing what's happening and you're making more enlightened decisions, the chances of regretting those decisions are much less. Comments. Would definitely need a guide, Kelly Trosser. I cannot tell you guys how important it is. And I'm going to tell you these guided meditations, this is my experience, the guided meditations on MP3 that you listen to in your ear, they're great to start with. Eventually, they are just a distraction. What you need to do is get a teacher, which I can't find. It's not for me, or a great book. And The Mind Illuminated for me was a great book. There are other great books. Talk to people, learn about it. Once you go through the steps and you have to be diligent, it takes practice. So I've been seriously meditating. And you guys have seen me do shows on meditation. I've been seriously doing it only for about 3 months now, for an hour a day. And in those 3 months, I've had a clarity of experience, an improved ability to concentrate in meditation. And I've seen some of the even higher stages of the meditative practice emerge. And they're tantalizing enough that you want to keep going. And I've had transient insight into this sort of selfless nature of consciousness. And some of that I think is because it's happened so fast for me because for 5 years I've been stabbing at it, right? Reading different books, listening to people like Sam Harris, who's a very secular sort of non-theistic way of understanding meditation, et cetera. And he's been through the path. If you're religious, come at it from your religious point of view and your religious practice. There are Christian mystics. There's Christian forms of prayer and meditation. There are Buddhist forms that are more iconographic. There are Islamic forms of this practice of introspection. So the tricky part is there's some hardcore literal theistic religious beliefs that for which this is heresy. So introspection is heresy. And I think those are a big impediment to understanding the true nature of who and what we are from whatever religious or non-religious perspective you want. But you have to do this stuff yourself, and getting a guide, a teacher, a book, whatever it is key. All of Patricia's submind screamed cheeseburger. I hear you, girl. I think I might have had a cheeseburger today. Laura Brosh, I've never been able to meditate. Once I relax, I'm asleep. Laura Brosh. Okay, so here's one of the tricks about meditation. Part of the mind system model of consciousness is that each that PowerPoint sitting in the boardroom gets one little frame at a time. There are like 8 different types, I think, of mind moments. So there's like an auditory type, a visual type, just frame, 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 frame. There's also a thinking type, a binding moment from the narrating mind. And then there's something called a non-perceiving mind moment. That's like the mind shooting a blank. A non-perceiving mind moment is just a state of just pleasurable blah. And when those are strung together enough in a sequence, you start to get very, very, very tired. And it's this peaceful, very pleasurable feeling of being drowsy. And the next thing you know, you're asleep. What's amazing about being persistent with meditation, so this used to happen to me too. What's amazing about being persistent with meditation is that once you start to recognize that that's happening, imagine your framework is now, okay, my eyes are closed and I'm starting to feel, oh, I'm actually aware of being drowsy. What's going on? Bunch of non-perceiving mind moments at a time are sitting there in the boardroom, and the rest of the mind submodules are like, it's time for Betty, bye. The energy level goes down, and next thing you know, you're asleep. The way that you combat that is, first of all, you meditate at the same time every day, usually when you're the most alert. So for me, it's in the morning right after I've gotten up and had coffee. For someone else, it may be a different time. Don't meditate after lunch when you're sleepy, right before bed when you're drowsy. Meditate when you're at your most alert. The second thing is, once you start to recognize what it, in the book, they call it dullness, what dullness feels like, you can intervene. So enough of the subminds recognize, oh, this is drowsy dullness. Okay. Next breath, pay perfect attention to it. And all the energy of the mind focuses on the next breath. The next thing you know, there's a little more energy. And that conscious intention, each little mind moment has an intention, and they lead to a kind of momentum to do stuff. So the more momentum you have to pay attention to the breath, that becomes self-fulfilling. And the energy of the mind increases, and you wake up. And this is what's amazing. By about stage 5 of the 10 stages of meditation they talk in the book, you've overcome this dullness almost entirely, to where you sit down, you get more and more alert the more present and still you get. And it is one of the most amazing feelings, because you know how it is. We're tired people in healthcare. To sit in the dark with your eyes closed at 4:30 in the morning and feel so alert and present and awake is a remarkable experience. All right, more comments. Keep the subminds busy, says Dwight Christensen, by going for a walk, a drive, a bicycle ride. Yeah, now the problem with that is these subminds act unconsciously. So when you're driving, the visual subminds coordinating with this motor discriminatory submind, and it's driving for you. If something jumps into the road, that's when that submind hijacks the PowerPoint in your boardroom and goes, look at this, everyone. And all the minds go, huh? And you have to make usually an unconscious decision to turn the wheel. Now, the difference is if you're actually there being mindful of that moment that you're driving, like you're really there, you're really present, and your mind is focused, when something flops out into the road, you actually have a buffer to come up with a more consensual submind decision on what to do. Instead of swerving into oncoming traffic to avoid this thing in the road, you actually make a more conscious, mindful decision to slowly put the brakes on, turn to the right, get to the shoulder. And that requires more subminds being mindful, being there and present, and having your boardroom really consciously deciding where it's going to pay attention to, having consensus of the subminds. Let's see. I'm so high strung, so bad that there's no way this is possible, LOL. Sean Erpelding. Dude, Sean, who the hell do you think you're looking at? Look at me. You guys have seen my show. I'm like, squirrel! I am the most ADD, jumping off the walls, hyper lunatic that you'll find in medicine, probably. You know what I'm saying? Short of an emergency doc, and I'm a hospitalist. It's not about that, because think about what that is. What that means is, Sean, your subminds are conditioned, right, to maybe have less inhibition, more anxiety, more discriminating minds ruminating more. You have maybe a more highly developed sense of this illusion of self. So you're always self-referring and going, am I going to screw this up? I'm worried about the past. I'm worried about the future. And that will make you feel like you have monkey mind, that your attention is all over the place. Here's the beautiful thing about meditation. It is the process of recognizing and overcoming that. So actually, the more high-strung you are, the more, you know, kind of nutty you feel, that will come out in the first few stages of meditation. You will recognize and see that for what it is, and you will overcome it with diligence. Just keep practicing. Don't practice blindly, though. Practice using the tools that are outlined by a teacher or by the book, because it will actually give you the tools. Oh, monkey mind is happening. You're jumping all over the place. Well, here's a trick. If you're trying to focus on the breath and you're getting distracted by thoughts, expand what you focus on mentally to include your whole body, any sensation in your body. It turns out, remember I talked about the mind moments? It turns out that the more you only have one mind moment at a time. And if you're trying to focus on something narrow like the breath, sometimes that's so narrow that other thoughts and stuff, it's easy for them to intrude. If you have to focus your awareness over the whole body, including the breath, it's such a big task that the entire sort of boardroom is engaged sending mind moments about different sensations in the body. And there's no room for intrusive thoughts. There's no room for distraction, at least for a period of time. And that, in that way, you can condition the subminds to quiet down. You know what's amazing? So here's the thing that just, and when I started reading ahead in the book, ahead of where my practice was, I was like, oh my God, if I can do this, like, this will be transformative. And I've had glimpses of it. As you meditate more, part of the idea is that you're getting all the subminds to agree on whatever it is you want to do. And in this book, it's follow the breath. Pay attention to the sensations of the breath at the tip of the nose, the cool, the sensation of flow, etc., without using too much concept. Like, you don't think about in-breath, out-breath. You just go, oh, that feels this way, that feels this way. The more you get them to focus, what ultimately happens is something called pacification of mind. When this happens, the subminds get reconditioned, because remember, this isn't a one-way street. Stuff just doesn't go into conscious awareness and disappear into a void. It's there for all the subminds to then see it and then process what's happening. If you ignore sounds, if you ignore distractions, if you ignore thoughts, let them come, let them be, let them go, long enough while redirecting attention in every conscious moment you can to your breath, the subminds start to get this message. They recondition and they start to quiet down. They stop serving you up this stuff. And that's called pacification of the mind. They then all focus on the same thing, which is the breath. And when that happens, people report in the higher stages of meditation, and I've had glimpses of this, full body sensations of bliss, the sensation that you're floating because there's no reference of bodily sensations, thoughts quiet down and disappear. And all you're left with is this, what they call meditative joy. It's this sense of, oh, wow, that the mind generates when all of its functions are unified around a single goal. In those settings, you can have these insight type experiences where you realize the self is an illusion. Everything arrives moment to moment in the present moment. My mind works this way. And by the final stages of meditative practice, stage 10, you actually are able to apply this to your waking non-meditative state. So you think about how the Dalai Lama may be. Nothing bothers the guy, right? But that doesn't mean he doesn't care about, you know, injustice or whatever it is. He's just able to approach the world from a place of equanimity, peace, non-reactivity, and love for everybody, even his enemies, but yet not let them off the hook because he still has his subminds just focused on whatever it is he's trying to do. So I'm using the Dalai Lama as an example. You could take any sort of non-religious figure that has been through meditative practice and you'll see the same thing. So it's really a remarkable goal. And the more you kind of look at the path and the goal, the more you realize, why haven't I been doing this for a long, long time? Comments. Carla just bought the book. Great. Now, one of the things about the book, Carla, it's heavy duty. Like, this is a heavy duty tome. It's like a textbook, but you go through it. The way I did it is I went stage by stage by stage slowly. And then I had a roadblock where I was just having trouble. I was so distracted. Every time I sat down, I was just monkey mind jumping off. And so I read ahead into the stages where things got really weird. Like, okay, pacification of the mind, the mind-body system, the moments of consciousness model. And I started going, oh, let me apply that back to my monkey mind And I sat down to meditate, and it was transformative. Like, I had absolute focus for that session. I was able to see the whole ocean of the mind with the breath right there. So attention on the breath, peripheral awareness on what the mind is doing. They call that in the book metacognitive introspective awareness. Don't worry about that. The idea is that you know what your mind is doing. So you're always mindful of what's happening, but yet you're focused on whatever it is the task is at hand. And it's really in healthcare, I think we could all use a lot more of this, and it can help us understand our patients and be less judgmental. Because if you think of your patient as just this neuronal storm of these subminds that have been conditioned, that have no insight into how they work and are just going through life firing, give me opioids, give me a warm blanket, you know, I'm going to continue to eat this crap even though I'm type 2 diabetic, that sort of thing. Your ability to have compassion for that and actually approach it from a place of wisdom is vastly transformed. Also, you forgive yourself. You have less self-hatred, less self-doubt, less worry about the future, less regret about the past. You appreciate how your mind responds to things and are less reactive, and you have a space to respond. Okay, let's see. Comments. So some people are recommending yoga. For some people, the body, okay, here's the thing about the body. We see the mind and the body as separate. The Buddhists and experienced meditators don't make that distinction. They refer to it as body-mind, body-mind. And it sounds spooky and new age, but really all it means is that it is a complex continuum of the same thing. In deep meditative states where you're doing body scanning meditations, you can actually feel this sort of one state of body and mind. And it's really quite remarkable. And it's actually a tool to help focus your concentration. Some people have really remarkable experiences with the body and the mind. Now think about this. When your mind is agitated, when you're filled with anxiety and worry, it manifests physically. We see it all the time. I'd say 50% of what we see in a primary care clinic is mind-related, either physical illness or somatic symptoms of something that's mind-related. And we have to address that. Right? So the mind and the body are one continuous thing. Let's see. Comments. So nice little exercise. Okay, wait. I'm going to skip that one. Okay. Sarah Chalk, ADHD makes meditating so hard for me. I'm great at active mindfulness, but sitting still, quiet, focusing on breathing doesn't work for me. Sarah, get this book. And he goes through all the different inhibitors to being able to pay attention on the breath. And kind of goes through, well, how do you actually modify these? How can you get around this problem? He actually mentions ADHD as an issue, but not one that is insurmountable. In fact, through training attention and meditation, you can actually improve the ADHD symptoms. That doesn't mean you have to get off medication and all this. It just means, listen, attention is the goal of meditation. Just because you have a diagnosis of ADHD doesn't mean that, it's like saying, look, my leg is really weak congenitally. Does that mean you shouldn't exercise your leg? No, it's more reason to exercise your leg. My attention is congenitally problematic. Wouldn't you want to exercise it? Wouldn't you want to make it more focused and better? And I think that's what this does. And again, I sound a little bit like a used car salesman, but remember, I don't really have a dog in this fight. This is my own personal experience. Now, here's the thing. I'm a hospital doctor. I practiced for about 10 years at Stanford. I, you know, worked in research labs. Like, I'm a scientist through and through. I want you to frame what I say through the idea that this is how a scientist sees meditation. This is how a skeptic who is pro-vaccination, anti-woo, hates Gwyneth Paltrow's goop, thinks Jenny McCarthy is insane, thinks Deepak Chopra is a shill, but who says a few things that actually make sense, but has gone down the path to the dark side of just new age mumbo jumbo, quantum consciousness and all this, it's garbage. Here's what's not garbage. You can empirically improve your mind through meditation. You don't have to believe anything. If you are an atheist, go get Sam Harris's book, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion, and he goes through this. If you are a evangelical Christian, go get Sam Harris's book, Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion, because you can apply it through your Christian lens to introspection. Maybe the inner illumination that you feel in a deep meditative state that precedes unification of mind, most meditators will report bright white light behind the eyelids. I've seen this myself, or fluttering flashing lights in deep meditative states. imagine you're, you know, a very religious, you might interpret that as a sort of a holy experience. And I think that's what's happened throughout history. Now, the danger is when you interpret an experience like that incorrectly and you go out and do something crazy. And I think some people do that as well. So we have to be aware of these real experiences through mindfulness, meditation, spirituality. They can have real world consequences if they're not framed with the right truth, whatever that is. You know what my bias is. Jose Martinez, yes, Sam Harris is awesome. Yes, Sam is who kind of introduced me to this concept because I'm a big skeptic. I love listening to his podcast. When I realized he had been a lifelong meditator, I'm like, wait, this can't be total BS. And then watching him, I learned a lot, and his book really opened my eyes. Now, that was like a few years ago that I read it, and I've been struggling for that long trying to find the path. Now, when I go back and listen to the book again on audiobook, it's so different. I see it so differently. I see what the path was that Sam was talking about. So it's important. It's very, 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 very difficult. So again, I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm telling you this because I'm honestly convinced. And believe me, I've been searching all my life for some way to be less of an a-hole, to be less reactive, to control the monkey mind. And you know, whether it was drugs in college or whether it was pouring myself into my work in my 30s as a doctor, or whether it was making silly rap videos and using humor as a way to cope, this is the first time when I felt like, oh, this has been here for thousands of years and I've totally missed it. And the more I explore it, the more I'm convinced that you guys could benefit from it. We could all benefit from it if we approach it with the right skepticism, with the right understanding and the right diligence. That's the thing. It's not magic. People who are trying to sell you magic are doing exactly that. They're trying to sell you something. Deepak Chopra sells these meditation glasses that have fancy lights and stuff. Come on, dude. And here's the thing. Again, like I said, the guided meditations are great when you start. They're great when you start. But once you get into it, turn all that ish off and really, really focus on the practice as laid out maybe in something like this book. All right. Oh, Christy Columbus saw my daughter behind me. She probably snuck in for a second. She does that. Let's see. I'm searching for a way not to cry at the drop of a dime. Joe, so the emotional submind is asserting itself, and there's probably a lot of trauma or conditioning or whatever that's happened that makes maybe there's some emotional lability. I mean, again, I'm a dime store psychologist here. Here's what I found, what is really interesting. Sometimes and this is a common experience, in a very deep meditative state where your concentration is very good and the submind's quiet down, you will just burst into tears. And there's no specific emotion behind it. And you just find yourself weeping in your meditative position. And I think part of that is, These are when the monkey mind stops thinking all the time and being identified with thought, unconscious thoughts, emotions, feelings come bubbling up and they're just there and they show up in the boardroom of consciousness and there you are crying and you don't know why. And I think that's one of the beautiful processes. Part of this process is there's a kind of a strange catharsis that happens where you let a lot of the stuff that's been hiding out in your unconscious come out. You know, psychotherapists can do this. You know, Freud talked about this stuff and he was partially right. The unconscious kind of runs the show and we ignore it at our peril. The Mind Illuminated is the name of the book. Brad Buckley, I get so far in, I assume in meditation, to the point that I'm floating and then I jump out of it with a complete body jerk. I get intense fear, full on fight or flight mode. Brad Buckley. Okay, so Brad, this comes up in the book. You need to get this book. So he talks about in the higher stages of meditation, it's normal to have sort of these tonic jerks, to feel these sort of electric sensations going through your body and to feel like you're floating as the senses start to pacify. What he says is there are some people who have a very adverse reaction to this. It's harmless physically, but people get so scared. And a lot of times it's because there's some unconscious stuff going on, either a trauma or a memory that has some affiliation with the sensations that you're having, and you'll snap out of the meditative state and be very afraid. So exactly what you describe is a not uncommon thing that can happen in the more advanced stages of meditation, or some people just have them happen early. So you might just be a meditative savant, Brad. And again, don't take any of this as medical or psychiatric advice. I'm just telling you what I've been learning in this book and trying to make some sense of it. Let's see. Hi from the Philippines. Miss the baldness. Shalom, Apostol. Shalom. You know, I'm very bald because I don't have the hair. I'm still working on my Filipino accent because all my nurses in Cali were Filipina or Filipino, and they were the best. So I picked up some of the accent and I even knew a few words for a while. You know what really, actually what really bugs me sometimes is like, we'll do something like the Metamoji where I'll do a Filipino accent and most everybody gets it, but there's a couple of Filipinas that get offended and I do feel bad. At the same time, I'm like, you know, it's done out from a place of love. Intention matters, right? If you're doing it to ridicule people, it's a different thing. So let's see, other stuff here. I'm skeptical too, like an emotional ferret, says Patty Wilden, but I love your style and humor. So maybe, Patty, you, my dear, are my target audience in this. So there are some people that are well into woo already that are just like, woo, new age, man. And there are some people that are so deep in the matrix that they're never going to meditate because they just associate it with clownery and woo. But there are some people who are on the fence because for me it was, well, as a lifelong sort of agnostic, trying to find a spirituality that actually worked for me in the setting of, you know, neuroscience, understanding the mind, personal development, was very hard. And finding this process, and actually weirdly finding it in a Buddhist context, because there are very secular strains of Buddhism that you don't believe anything. You don't have to believe in reincarnation or karma or any of this other stuff. By the way, karma, let's talk about that for a second. The idea of karma as this like resonant, you know, mystical field is not my understanding of karma now that I've meditated more. Karma is simply the momentum of conscious intention of the subminds. So in other words, if you have an intention to help somebody and you help them, that conscious intention generates a kind of momentum in the mind that can continue and good things can happen. Conversely, if you focus on negativity and you're constantly doing bad things, thinking bad thoughts, doing bad, meaning things that harm other conscious entities, you have a momentum that creates this sort of negative karma. The word karma is woo-woo, but the action of momentum of intention is actually a real thing. Now, I'm not talking about this Oprah secret BS where it's like, I can just intention something into being. No, that's pseudoscientific crap. I'm talking about just how the mind works. If it's a series of mind moments strung together in a momentum and a flow, wouldn't you want the most sort of positive mind moments you can get to get actual positive outcomes? If our mind creates the world around us and how we see it, wouldn't that be our own kind of karma? That's how I see karma. And it's nothing religious. You don't have to believe anything. It's just an empiric observation of the nature of how the universe works. Let's see. More comments. These comments and questions are very good. For some reason, I knew you were going to go off on karma. Andrea Aponte. Yeah, you know, it's funny. Noella Hame says karma is amazing. So I once told a devout Hindu that I thought karma was BS. And they described it to me in terms that finally made some scientific sense to me, which is exactly that. It's the kind of momentum groove that we wear in through our thoughts and our actions and our deeds. And they do come back because there's a momentum that's created. Think about it this way. If there's no self in your mind making decisions, it's this consensus of unconscious minds. Well, what actually determines what happens in the world? Well, it's all this prior conditions and causes that lead our sub minds to make these decisions. Now, the more we pay attention to this in our boardroom, the more we can actually executively get a consensus of sub minds to do things we want them to do. We meaning the consensus of sub minds, do better things in the world, be nicer to people, show more love, be less reactive. And that generates a momentum that ripples out. You're nice to people. Generally, you'll find that they're nice to you. If they're not nice to you, but you approach them in a non-judgmental, non-reactive way, you're not going to feel that as them being viciously mean. You're just going to see suffering in their body mind and go, that person's suffering if they're acting out this way. Like, that must be a deep kind of pain. I know what that feels like because I felt that. So cognitively, I understand what they're going through and I'm going to be less reactive. It's not about me, first of all, because there is no me. But second of all, it's really more about their own suffering. So that is sort of karma. Does Z-Mom have any books she'd recommend, Tracy Weaver? I'll have to ask Z-Mom. So Z-Mom is not a meditator, neither is Z-Dad. They're both moderately anxious type A's. They've learned to work their magic through their brain, and as they've aged, they've gotten better at it. But my mom is an anxious Nelly, and my dad is an anxious Nelly. And so actually it was partially on their modeling. Now my dad is very religious. So I'm a Zoroastrian by birth. It's an ancient monotheistic religion. Had a prophet Zoroaster who came down and said, think good thoughts, do good deeds, speak good words, more or less. And there was a devil in him, basically, in the simplistic description. So it influenced early Judaism, early Christianity, etc. Me being agnostic, I just took the ritual out of it. You know, there was chanting and sort of priests when I was a kid, when I was going through my equivalent of a bar mitzvah. But my dad still has his little prayer area, and he says these ancient, you know, Persian prayers and chants them and does all of this stuff. And I used to kind of, when I was younger and more militantly agnostic, I would sort of criticize him and go, what are you doing, man? Like, you're wasting so much time chanting to an imaginary God that doesn't hear you, and, you know, science, buddy. And after going down this sort of meditative path, what I see is he is seeking his own connection with the true reality of what and who he is and his place in everything. And the last time I went back home, you know, he was doing his, he always tries to get me to do these prayers with him, because since I was baptized in the faith, he just assumes that every now and again I'll you know, pray to this, you know, God and go through these rituals. But of course I don't. So every time I come home, I have to go through this pretend motion of sitting there in front of the shrine, and he burns incense and makes me, you know, mentally recite these prayers that I learned as a kid in a language I don't understand. And I used to resent it. I used to hate it. I used to get uncomfortable. I wanted to jump out of my skin. And the last time I went over there with this sort of minimal perspective that I've gained from all this practice of meditation and mindfulness and understanding mind body and trying to seek some bigger truth about what it is we actually are. We're not our thoughts and our emotions and our mind even. We're this awareness in which it all arrives, and somehow it's all connected. And I told him, I said, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to treat this belief system that you have as a framework for your own way to discover the same thing I'm trying to discover. And I'm going to say these prayers with a different way of looking at it. I'm going to say them as a mantra to try to focus my attention on the now and how much, you know, my loved ones mean to me and what, you know, all the gratitude and great things that I have. And I tell you, it was one of those things where it was, and you know, he knew it too. Like, you could tell he was like, oh my gosh. Yeah. And I said, well, this is how I see this ritual. And he said, honestly, that's how I see it too. First time we've ever really talked about it beyond just the dogma of the act. Now, think about that when you go to church or when you're raising your kids or when you're thinking about your own position in the universe. You know, what? We're all struggling for meaning and connection. That's why sometimes I find, you know, the hardcore skeptic, atheist, non-meditator is a little difficult to wrap the brain around, because if you're trying to just get a sense of awe in the science of the universe and all that, that's great. But without deep introspection to really feel what you are, it's hard. And I think that's what I was missing in my 30s and 20s when I was sort of a little more militant. So there you have it. Gosh, I think I've said too much. Laura Brosh, we are mind, body, spirit. I want to unpack that for a second, because that can sound like religious mumbo jumbo, but here's what I think. Mind and body are the same thing. They're just a continuum. And the more you kind of introspect and actually experience this, you see this as true. It's really a field of energy that you feel. Spirit, for lack of a better word, and it's where the term spirituality comes from too. Spirit is simply, in my mind, the deep sense of who you actually are, which is awareness itself. In other words, What is it that is knowing all of this? Try to think back to what that is. Can you identify it in your mind? What is actually doing the knowing? What is aware of this bald man talking to you right now? What is it that is aware? This is true self-inquiry. Who am I? The real I, capital I, the self that is knowing all of this. And you look and you look and you look and you won't find it. And that is the Holy Spirit, for lack of a better term. And you don't have to believe in God. You don't have to believe in anything. But that is an inexplicable fundamental truth of everything that is. And I think that's what ultimately meditation might lead you to, but I'm not there yet. So on that very woo-woo note, remember, I'm a skeptic. I'm a scientist. I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm just telling you where I am in my own path. And I hope it was helpful to you guys. Leave some questions. I actually read these comments and will try to answer when I find that one is something that I might be able to help with. It means a lot to me that you would sit through the 300 people that have been with me from the beginning of this, sit through this. And if you guys like it at all, I will try. The more I learn, the more I'll try to impart what little I can do to y'all. All right, guys. I love you. We out. Peace.